July.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Audit and Investigation Committee certify, to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting, that at the just concluded executive session of the Audits and Investigations Committee of today, May 14th, and at the executive session of the Audits and Investigations Committee of April 17th, that took place via teleconference, only such matters that are authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Bylaws Article 10, and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive sessions were convened, were heard, discussed, or considered by the committee.
Second.
Second. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. I am concluded.
All right, with that, we will convene the Planning Program Development and Real Estate Committee meeting, and I'm going to do something very familiar. I'm going to move that the Planning Program Development and Real Estate Committee certify, to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting, that at today's just concluded executive session of the committee on May 14th, 2015, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Bylaws Article 10, and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive session was convened, were heard, discussed, or considered by the committee. Can I have a second?
Second.
All who approve?
Aye.
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 No dissenters? Thank you very much. Great. Chief Safety Officer, take it away, Mr. Doherty.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Trigoni and members of the board. In the event of an emergency or the fire alarm activation, we'd ask that you exit either to my right or left through one of the through the exit doors, preferably through the front entrance, across the street in the crosswalk at 5th and G, and we will assemble in the corner of the building museum to make sure that everyone is accounted for. Our safety contact this morning, as the weather has warmed up a bit, is on water and swimming safety. As we prepare for the swim season and pool openings, I'd like to remind you about some simple tips for an enjoyable summer. First, stay close, being alert and watching children in and around the pool. Never leave a child unattended in a pool or spa, and always watch your child when he or she is near the water. Teach children basic water safety tips. Keep children away from pool drains, pipes, and other openings to avoid any entrapments. Have a telephone close by when you or your family is using a pool or spa. If a child is missing, look for him or her first in the pool or spa area and share your safety instructions with family, friends, and neighbors. Second, learning and practicing water safety skills. Learn how to swim, if you don't already know, and teach your child how to swim. Learn to perform CPR on children and adults and update those skills regularly. Understand the basic facts of life-saving so that you can assist in a pool emergency. And third, have appropriate equipment for your pool or spa. Install a 4-foot fence or taller fence around a pool or spa and use self-closing and self-latching gates. Ask your neighbors to do the same if they have a pool. Install and use a lockable safety cover on your spa. If your house serves as a fourth side of a fence around a pool, install door alarms and always use them. For additional protection, window guards may be advised. Ensure any pool and spa you use has compliant drain covers, and ask your pool service provider if you're not sure what covers should be there. Maintain your pool and spa covers in good working orders at all times. Madam Chair, that concludes our safety contact for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Has everyone had a chance to take a look at the agenda? All right. Would anyone like to move approval of today's agenda? I'll move it. Second?
Who's on the committee? This is one of these things where if you're on the committee, you have to be ready to make the noise.
okay. So... Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Thank you. We also have minutes to consider from March 12th. I hope everyone's had a chance to take a look at the minutes from the March 12th PPDRE committee meeting, as well as the March 12th executive session meeting. And I'd like to entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Thank you. Second? I'll second it. I can look myself.
Mr. Yule is the Virginia member. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One of you guys. Maybe that's one of the guys.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Thank you. All right. We have on the agenda today two action items and an information item. The two action items will advance joint development at our Metro Rail stations, and the third item provides the committee with a regional analysis of how these developments and others in the region will affect ridership in the near-term future. Our first item is a joint development project at the Capitol Heights station. This mixed-use project will serve as an anchor among the 1.3 million square feet of proposed development around the Capitol Heights station, an important gateway between the District of Columbia and Prince George's County. Next, the committee will be asked to approve a term sheet for a joint development project at the Grosvenor Strathmore station. In addition to providing residents the opportunity to live adjacent to a transit hub, this project will physically integrate the metro station with the surrounding community. Lastly, we're going to hear from Sham Kanan, the Managing Director of Planning, who'll provide the committee with an analysis of the near-term impact of metro-adjacent development projects on metro ridership. As the region continues to focus development at or near metro stations, such as the two projects the committee will consider today, detailed information such as this will be helpful in many ways to Metro in service planning, but also to the jurisdictions in financial planning for Metro. I think it's important that when we consider any of these transactions that Mr. Wall brings to us, that we're also looking at what is the longer-term impact of ridership on ridership and revenue for the agency given different land use possibilities. With that, I'll turn this the floor over to Mr. Wall for the first action item.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you, and good morning to the members of the committee. Staff's first action today is a request for board approval to negotiate and execute a term sheet with Donatelli Development as a selected developer for the Capitol Heights development site. The Capitol Heights site was offered approximately 1 year ago in our April 2014 joint development solicitation. The site consists of two parcels, the current park and ride surface lot and a vacant parcel to the east of the parking lot. We received one proposal from Donatelli Development, and after staff review, we determined that proposal did achieve our evaluation criteria. This aerial photo shows the existing Capitol Heights station with the bus loop to the left, then the Kiss and Ride, and then the surface parking lot outlined in red. A smaller parcel to the east of the site is also being transferred to this developer, which will be a site for townhomes in that smaller site. The developer is proposing approximately 200 residential units and 12,000 square feet of ground floor retail. Approximately 100 to 120 parking spaces will be built for the development, a ratio of approximately 0.5 to 0.6 spaces per unit. The existing Metro bus loop and Kiss and Ride will be maintained in their current location. We're proposing to relocate the park and ride parking to the Morgan Boulevard station, where it can be more easily accommodated on our much larger parcel there, rather than trying to fit commuter parking structure on the current constrained Capitol Heights station. Staff will be conducting a ridership and revenue impact analysis to determine the exact number of spaces that will be replaced, and that information will be presented to the board as part of the joint development agreement approval later this year. While the project on the Metro-owned property is fairly modest at 200 units, it is indeed a component of a much larger wave of development activity occurring around the Capitol Heights station. In total, the six projects that surround the station represent 1.3 million square feet of development, 900 residential units, and over 200,000 square feet of retail, all of which will come online in the next 5 to 7 years at the Capitol Heights station. The proposed joint development project supports Metro's strategic plan goals of connecting communities and ensuring financial stability. Further, it achieves all of our joint development program objectives. As relates to the last objective of encouraging revitalization, Metro staff have been working in close coordination with Prince George's County staff from the Office of the County Executive and the Planning Department, as well as the Town of Capitol Heights, to coordinate our development efforts in the area. Further, we're working with county planners to help support implementation of a new Central Avenue Corridor bike and pedestrian trail that will provide enhanced access to the Capitol Heights station and the other Blue and Silver Line stations in the corridor all the way to Morgan Boulevard and Largo. The proposed joint development project by itself is proposed to add 176 daily trips to Metro's ridership, along with $155,000 in new annual ridership revenue. However, when combined with the other development activity in the area, we're projecting over 1,300 new daily trips and over $1.1 million in new ridership revenue. With these very significant benefits to Metro, staff is recommending board approval to negotiate and execute a term sheet with Donatelli Development as a selected developer for the Capitol Heights Joint Development Site. Thank you.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Madam Chair, I'm pleased to move approval.
Thank you. Second? Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next item is the obtaining board approval to negotiate and execute a term sheet with Streetscape Partners as a selected developer for the Grosvenor Strathmore Joint Development Site. The 4.25-acre Grosvenor Strathmore site was offered in our November 2013 joint development, and we received three proposals. Streetscape Partners best achieved our evaluation criteria for this site. This photo shows the remaining Metro-owned property at Grosvenor, consisting of a bus loop, kiss-and-ride parking lot, a commuter parking lot, and a parking structure. The proposed development will be located in the area of the surface parking lot, just to the south of the existing parking structure. The development program will consist of approximately 550 residential units and approximately 6,000 square feet of retail. The developer is contemplating between 330 and 550 parking spaces for the private development, a ratio of between 0.6 and 1.0. The existing bus loop and kiss-and-ride facilities will be maintained in their current locations, while the park-and-ride surface parking will be replaced in an extension to the existing parking structure.
Can I pause you there, Mr. Yeah. Well, can you go back to the previous slide and just show us where the options are for where that replacement parking will be?
The parking structure could be extended to the south to cover a portion of that existing surface parking lot, or it could be extended to the west to cover a portion of the existing kiss-and-ride and bus loop. Our preference is to the west. However, it does present some logistical challenges in terms of accommodating the bus loop and kiss and ride. But what it does, it frees up much more space of the parking lot for a better development right at the entrance to the station. But in all cases, we will be replacing the parking on a one-for-one basis at the Grosvenor site.
And as I understand it, the other advantage of the western location is that you'd be able to build that garage before you had to take the surface parking out of operation, which would be less disruptive for the current parkers?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And we will actually, as part of the development plan and coming back for the joint development agreement approval, the developer will be providing us a maintenance of facility or maintenance of operations and interim facilities plan that will discuss how they'll maintain and moderate the impacts to parkers during the development period.
Thank you. Please continue.
The benefits of this project, it directly supports Momentum Strategic Plan goals of improving regional mobility and connecting communities, and it also, again, achieves all of Metro's Joint Development Program objectives. In terms of ridership and revenue impacts, the proposed project is expected to generate 654 new daily trips and approximately $633,000 annually in new ridership revenue. With these benefits in mind, staff is recommending board approval to negotiate and execute a term sheet with Streetscape Partners as a selected developer for the Grosvenor Strathmore Joint Development Site. Thank you.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Oh, please. Oh, can we? That's great. We have the motion on the table. Yes? Can we have a second before we discuss? Second? Anyone? Thank you. Please. Question?
Yes, ma'am. On the solicitation process for this particular project, how many respondents did you have?
We received three respondents for this site.
Okay. Do you have any sense of why you had three responses for this parcel versus just one response for the previous one?
It's definitely a market interest in terms of the economics of this site and the attractiveness of this site today are much stronger than in the Capitol Heights area.
So in terms of the timing of your solicitation, why would you advance the Capitol Heights project before the market was ready?
The market is ready for Capitol Heights. We received just the one proposal, but it was a very strong proposal from that team. We have advanced other sites where we received one proposal, and in those cases we haven't proceeded if the proposal wasn't a strong offer for Metro. In the case of Capitol Heights, it was a very strong proposal with a very experienced team that's done past joint development projects on Metro property, so we felt that it was the right team to move forward with that site. It serves to advance other county objectives in terms of trying to stimulate economic development in and around this area, and working again closely with the county on the other surrounding projects creates a real kind of magnet of development right there at Capitol Heights.
Okay. I will say, just in response to this, again, taking the long view about what happens with Metro revenue and ridership if we leave the site vacant versus if we put development on the site, I think that's also a consideration in a case like this. Mr. Goldman?
Thank you. Well, not a member of the committee, I did want to ask you a few more questions about the facility and the parking situation. This is an important facility for the county, both because a very busy garage serves as a busy garage for commuters coming in, but it also serves as a parking facility for the Strathmore Performing Arts Center, which is located directly to the north. So you've got commuters during the day, and then you have people going to concerts in the evening on the weekends. So the loss, the potential loss of the 412 parking spots is very critical, and obviously from the county's point of view and Strathmore's point of view, we would prefer the expansion of the garage to the west rather than to the south, because going to the west wouldn't require any loss of the spaces on a temporary basis. But how could you perhaps explain how WMATA with the developer will come to a decision on which option to choose, and what is the timeline for the project? When would you see construction beginning and the loss of the parking spots, if there is that option that's selected?
Following the approval of the term sheet, we'll immediately begin negotiating the joint development agreement. And as part of that process will be this maintenance of operations and interim facilities plan with the developer. We will work closely with both the Strathmore Performing Arts Center as well as the surrounding community and county planners to make sure that the proposed plan for the development as well as the interim facilities plan is something that minimizes impact on our current commuters, the existing people that walk to and from the station that surround the area, as well as to the customers of Strathmore. In terms of timing, that's probably approximately 2 to 3 years before we would see construction beginning on this site to allow for negotiation of those agreements, for the developer to obtain their necessary entitlements and approvals, and then actually break ground the project. The very first phase of the project will be the garage. Whether it goes to the south or to the west, that will be the first component that's delivered on the site, and then the vertical development would follow after that.
So the timing would be construction would begin 2018 or 2019, is that the time period?
2017, 2018, correct.
And how far before then would a decision be made as to whether option one or two is made on the...
We will have that decision when we come back for the joint development agreement approval later this year. So within the next 6 months, we'll come back with that analysis and proposed concept for
the
garage.
By the end of 2015.
Correct, yes.
And just to underscore what you just said, through this process now, you'll be consulting both with county as well as with the Blackmore Performing Arts Center.
Absolutely.
Parts of your plan.
Yes.
And not just the committee, but the full board will get a chance to weigh in once we have that development agreement.
Thank you.
Mr. Darmshaw?
Yes. Prior to the advertisement of a joint development solicitation, do you do any market soundings?
We do. We actually, and we're actually working on that as relates to our College Park site, which we plan to offer later this summer. In the case of that site, that was a case where we did receive one proposal last year for that site. We did not move forward with that team because it wasn't a strong enough proposal for us. So as part of, looking at how do we increase the demand and interest in that particular site, we're working with the county, with the University of Maryland, with the town of College Park to collectively determine, you know, how do we generate more interest in the corridor. We're planning to conduct a pre-bid conference and development showcase in June or July to show potential developers in the community everything that's happening around the site, just to generate more excitement for our property as an anchor to that other developments happening next door. We also are doing direct outreach to developers to ask, you know, why aren't you looking at this site, and what factors would make them more interested in bidding on that property. So all of these things with the goal of trying to, you know, find out what might make it difficult for developers to bid on our sites, and also, you know, generate more competition for that particular property.
Great. Any other questions or discussion? Okay. May I ask a member of the committee to second the motion to approve? We got a second, but I need a committee member to do that.
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Wall, appreciate it. And then Mr. Kanaan, I think we're ready for you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sean Cunningham, and I run the planning office here at Metro. And we're going to talk this morning about real estate in a more long-term context, and specifically its impact upon ridership. And the reason why we're doing this is because we've noticed that over the past 10, 15 years that the way this region has evolved is towards product types and the asset, different asset classes that are having more of a specific impact upon our ridership. And it's important for us to take into context these regional growth processes in a strategic fashion so that we can perhaps think about how we can utilize the portfolio of land assets we do have, as well as work with our jurisdictions who are in the process of moving land assets towards development, so that we can have a sustainable platform of real estate to drive ridership. So big picture, this is the broad arc of ridership trends that we've experienced since the rail system's inception. As you can see, there have been ebbs and flows in ridership, and some of the times these growth spurts have taken place immediately after or after large capacity increases. In some other cases, there have been stagnant periods of ridership growth or even ridership decline after periods of significant capacity increases. The one thing we do know is that as this region has grown and added jobs and households, the long-term trend in ridership has followed the long-term trend in jobs and household growth in the region, and that number is up. We also know that we've been using a variety of different sources inside the house to project short-term ridership and medium-term ridership changes so that we can provide some sense of what the budget might look like for Metro Rail. And the models that we do have in-house at a system level have been proven to predict at a 94% level of accuracy the near-term changes in ridership that we, in fact, do experience. The significance of the work I'm presenting you today is that we're noticing that there are large variations in those ridership changes that perhaps are masked at the system level. For instance, the impact of huge amounts of infill development in the district in places like NoMa, in places like Capitol Riverfront, in places along the northern branches of the Green Line in the district. These are places where we're actually seeing ridership increases despite the more recent trend of flatlining or the past several years of some ridership decreases. And those impacts are most directly tied to the land uses and the development that's taking place at and around our stations. Why is that? Well, it turns out that somewhere between, 40 and 78% of our overall ridership, depending on AM and PM peak, is actually driven by walk ridership, meaning that those riders are coming to our stations on foot. On average, it's somewhere around 60% of our total ridership, and as transit-oriented development becomes more and more commonplace, as this region densifies, that walk ridership becomes more and more important for us to focus in on and understand how much of it's coming, how much more development is going to promote more walk ridership, and should we be prepared for that? I think those of you that are traveling around the region, that were on the roads today perhaps, you can see a number of cranes dotting the skyline, and we'll walk through what we're seeing from a data perspective on that, but the important piece to remember is that it's a significant portion of our overall ridership, and there's more of it on the way. why is it a significant portion of our ridership equation? Well, this is just taking a look at households within the walk shed. And you can see there's a fairly clear linear relationship between the amount of households that are in the walk sheds at our station areas and the AM peak entries. And what we, at the planning staff, started to do is isolate what's driving this. What do we know about the quantity of stuff that's at or near our Metrorail stations, and why is it that we see these relationships between stations that have significant amounts of development and or significant amounts of accessibility and more pronounced actual entries? It's good for us when we see more entries because we recognize the revenue, and certainly we want to make sure that we are advancing where we can the types of projects and or working with our jurisdictional partners as they advance projects that drive revenue to us. Now, this, you can see this particular very simple regression suggests that there's a 70% correlation between the amount of household density at or near a Metrorail station and AM peak ridership. We were intrigued by this, and we wanted to explore more. What we found out is that there are a number of factors that actually contribute beyond simply the household counts within the walk shed. What you're looking at is you're looking at two maps drawn at the same scale, and you're looking at two different pictures of ridership. Boston, where we see morning walk access of almost 3,000 trips in the AM peak entering that station. You can see the size of that purple or lavender blob indicating how far you can walk from that Metrorail station before you finish walking a half mile. Meanwhile, Cheverly, that blue blob or purplish blob is much smaller. I mean, you're really barely exiting the Metrorail station before you've walked a half a mile. And that's a function of both the formal and informal walking paths that are available to our pedestrians. And no surprise, you can walk to less stuff. Fewer people can actually get to the station from either their homes or places of business. Our AM peak entries there are much lower. So this is a microcosm example of the type of analysis that we undertook to understand the relationship between the land uses, the land conditions, the quantities of stuff, and the household concentrations at or near Metrorail stations. We can see another example here. This is a slightly more pronounced example, Bethesda versus Suitland. Despite the fact that Suitland does have a major employment center and significant amounts of parking, its ridership is much lower throughout the day than a station like Bethesda, which has county-sponsored parking, no metro-sponsored parking, but a lot of transit-oriented development and high-density development at or near that station. Not only is the overall ridership during the day higher, but the ridership throughout the day is more balanced. So we're seeing more midday trips. We're seeing a balance of both AM peak entries and then AM peak, and then also PM peak entries because it's both a housing center and a job center. That type of activity is great for Metrorail because, A, we get to take in more revenue, but also we get to maximize the utilization of that capacity throughout the day. So we decided to build a model that understood the relationship between land use and ridership, and without going through all the elements of the actual regression analysis, we'll say that the model we have now at a micro level does actually predict 70 to 90% of the relationship between the land uses that are taking place at the station area and the ridership that we're experiencing at that station area. To boil it down to three primary factors, what we find is that during the peak, the density of households and jobs at or near the station area is a primary driver of ridership. In the off-peak, the quantity of retail, restaurants, and entertainment jobs happens to be a significant driver of ridership. And then also the size of those blobs, the accessibility of the station, train frequency, how often we're servicing that station, and then importantly, how many jobs you can get to within a 30-minute commute on the system are important drivers of ridership. And so among the over 200 independent variables that we threw out this model and tested every which way to Sunday, these are the factors that stuck and were very, very accurate predictors of ridership. So let's tie this back to real estate. What we're looking at behind me is a map of the development pipeline that's been provided to us by private real estate sources. So we asked Jones Lang LaSalle, which is on contract with us, to tell us what's under construction and what do we anticipate will be under construction by 2020. And what they've told us is that there's about 100 million square feet of projects either under construction today or planned to be under construction in the next 10 years. About 30% of what you're looking at behind me is actually under construction today. Interesting stats here. Of all the office construction in this region right now, 86% of that is actually under construction within a half mile of Metrorail. Of all of the leases, 20,000 square feet or higher in this region, 92% of those leases are taking place within a half mile of Metro Rail. So huge amounts of development intensity planned for a very finite area and lots of it concentrated around Metro Rail. We asked ourselves the question, well, what does this mean for ridership? If all of this development is not just forecast to happen, but we can actually see it happening right now, the pylons are in, the cranes are up, what will this do to our station volumes? What will this do to ridership in the near term? And so the answer is that we're projecting that the impact of all that development is roughly an increase of about 84,000 trips per day, or almost a 10% increase in ridership over the next 5 to 7 years. And that means that on an annual on a daily basis, the system should be taking in somewhere around $240,000 to $260,000 additional dollars per day. It's a pretty conservative assumption. And that is just a function of what we know mathematically about how our system behaves when you add development at or near Metro Rail stations.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
And I would encourage my fellow committee members to do so as well. So one of the other things that's changing, in addition to how we're developing and using land and how much infill is happening and how much in all of our jurisdictions, we have suburban sites that are urbanizing, like Tysons, like Rockville. The nature of work is changing a little bit. There's more teleworking. Frank Wolf is finally getting what he always dreamed of. And we see a lot more telework happening. Have you calculated that at all in how you estimated farebox revenue in particular and trips?
Yeah, so the beauty here is that we're actually taking a look. This is not a theoretical model of how the world might work. This is based upon actual system performance today. So if we look at how workers are behaving today in a world where many folks are teleworking, and what the relationship is between today's land uses and today's work patterns, these are the trip generation outputs that our world of 2015 is exhibiting. So in effect, if we assume that the world over the next 10 years continues to behave like the world today or even accelerates, we should see these patterns continue to prevail. The other thing to remember is that we're making a very, very conservative assumption that when we add development here, that the new job is associated with the same new household that's moving into the residential project that is also affiliated with this development forecast. What that means is that the forecast that we're putting together could be as much as 50% too conservative. If we are, in fact, adding a job to Metrorail and that job is moving an employee from somewhere else in the region to a Metro-adjacent facility, and the residential product is attracting a different individual than the person who's taking that new job, then we're looking at potentially double the 84,000 trips, additional trips per day that we're forecasting here. So no one has the perfect crystal ball on what telework is going to do to the future of the country, but we know that if people are teleworking today, we're capturing that.
And so you're going out in this projection, is this 7 years? Is that what you said?
So this is going until the end of the planned and under construction pipeline. So this assumes up until the years 2020, 2021. That's when the projects that we've been told are expected to be delivered and occupied by then are in that map that was previously shown.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
So one of the interesting phenomena we're seeing in Arlington is a reduction in the amount of square foot per person, down from 250 when I went on our board in 2008, almost to 125 right now. That's what they're looking for. Is that factored into this as well, Sean?
Yeah, so we use 120 square feet per worker as opposed to, I mean, actually in some of the law firms where you were dealing with, you know, C-suite spaces, they were as high as 450 back in the heyday. So we're using a much more aggressive number of 120 square feet per worker. Now that varies by class of office space. So we did drill down, we did use NAICS codes to isolate the different types of employment. And so for example, retail employment has a much, much higher square foot per employee threshold than commercial office. 9-to-5 work has a much, much higher density of office work, of worker per square foot than non-9-to-5 work. So we were able to apply that level of detail.
The other question I have for you is the relative size of the circles.
Yes.
Is sort of an interesting thing, and you talked before about some weather places has a good walk shed, for lack of a better way to describe that. There's certainly another piece of the puzzle, which is these major bus transfer locations also have some, but I'm sort of intrigued by some of the size of some of the others, and wondering whether this has implications for how we think about a station having regional significance versus being more of a local serving station. Okay. And I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Sure. I mean, so there's three questions packed into that. The first, I'll answer very quickly. This model only takes into account rail ridership at this point in time.
Okay.
And it only takes into account rail ridership that's driven by walk entries. Remember, going back to that first slide, it was about 62-68% of the entries depending on time of day. And the reason is that when you start to get into things like park and ride or commuter bus access to Metrorail, the relationship between adjacent land uses and the entries is far less significant. So we're focusing in on specifically the impact of adjacent uses. There is concurrent work underway, and I think that we've brought to the board several times a proposed methodology for determining the regionalness, if you will, or the relative regionalness of system stations as well as system elements. And that does take into account the distribution. One of the factors that was incorporated in that methodology was the distribution of ridership by jurisdiction of residence. But that methodology, I think, should stand on its own, because what this can't tell us, is whether or not the jurisdiction of residence of the exit, AMP exit, is coming from jurisdiction one or jurisdiction two. We just know that they're going to be exiting there.
Well, I think as this all moves forward, I will say that we have been looking at the issue of adding second entrances and what that does to extending the walk shed at Ballston. It's quite significant how much more walkability is actually created by putting a western entrance, because it's an eastern entrance-oriented station. But the other thing, and again, from the Virginia perspective, is there's a huge interest in rapid bus on I-66 coming both from Loudoun and from the edges of Prince William, Manassas, et cetera, where 66 goes. And we are working really hard to figure out how to best connect that into the metro station. But that could be, in essence, a real game changer in terms of how many people are using transit from far beyond where Metro Rail extends at the moment. And so the picture may vary. I know Montgomery and others have got bus rapid on too, but it seems to me at some point, and it goes back, as it always does, to this conversation we had several years ago about how much capacity do we have in the core,
right,
and how does the region prioritize making sure that that capacity matches what each one of us might be doing to move people toward the core.
I think there's a slide that begins to address the capacity issues.
It does. So I think one of the, if you might allow me to double click on your note, on your comment for a moment, one of the important things to recognize here is that there is a structural disconnect between how jurisdictions recognize real estate impacts and how Metro recognizes real estate impacts. In a sense, the jurisdictions do often get to recognize the property tax impacts of development, whereas Metro, we do get to take the fare box, but don't get anywhere near the real estate impacts that it's enjoyed by the jurisdictions. What we do have to do, though, is to then put capacity back into the system to carry the riders that are being added onto the system by this development. And so I suppose this board needs to be very conscious of the fact that this ridership is coming. The foundations are dug, the cranes are in the ground, and if the jurisdictions are benefiting from the real estate development, which they are, there has to be a discussion about the extent to which those benefits that are real estate driven can in part or in whole offset the then triggered capital needs that this system will face as a result of that development. So we are building what's called a capital needs early warning system that helps us understand where those impacts are taking place. But that, I think, is the important piece.
Mr. Boulder, please.
So the age-old question is pay Peter, you know, Peter to pay Paul. Can you monetize what you just told us?
I think the jurisdictions can.
I don't have the answer. Is all this crane development and these circles generate X commercial real estate and residential property taxes to by jurisdiction or just region-wide versus capital contributions?
That's a great question.
Capital program.
We haven't done that. We haven't done an asset-by-asset fiscal impact analysis. The scope of doing that level of analysis is something that is, it would be a cost to the program. We have not done that, but certainly it's something that...
Anecdotally, you're saying, Shyam, that all this development generates X dollars per annum in commercial and residential and sales taxes. I'll throw that in.
Sure.
And then compare that to... jurisdictional contributions would take what kind of an effort? Back of the envelope?
It's more than back of the envelope, unfortunately, just because each asset is very, very specific, and oftentimes the deals that are struck or whether they're sitting inside the special assessment districts or whether or not they're instance at grandfather taxation districts is complicated. So it's a lot of square footage to do a back of the envelope analysis. But the larger point is that there's a lot of stuff coming online. We have to be ready to handle it.
Well, another question then. It's a different question, Madam Chair. Again, we see the imbalance on the east side of the system versus the core versus the west side. It's startling. Has that changed much? The only big change I see, Shyam, is on the east side is Largo, where we're sending Silver Line trains to. Is that a hospital?
There's a medical center that is something that Mr. Wall has also coordinated tightly on. That's something that Prince George's County is very proud about moving forward, and we're partnering with them on that.
Is that the new Prince George's County Hospital that the county executive wants in Prince George's? Would it go up there?
It's a regional medical center, the Omnis. So that is the...
That could be a big hit.
It could be a big hit. It would be a job center on the eastern side and allow us to put some seats, sell some seats going eastbound in the morning.
I hope it's near Largo. The proposed Prince George's Hospital is near our station.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
I hope so.
So I think we have another question,
Mr.
Downing.
Still up here. Okay.
Let me ask. Not to put a pall on the discussion, but square feet don't generate ridership. Business activity taking place in that location is what generates the activity. And to the extent developers are building this space, how confident are they that it will fill up? And secondly, how much impact would there then be in current Class B space that may collect some of these jobs? I'm thinking back of see-through buildings in New Jersey all through the 70s. I'm thinking Houston and Denver after they built for the energy boom in the 70s, and it didn't happen. And part of this is to what extent is the region trying to retool its economy to not live in the fact that the federal government is continually cutting back?
So one important stat to keep into account is that of the pipeline I just showed you, a typical underwriting characteristic for commercial real estate would be to have somewhere between 25 and 30% of the project pre-leased before you go to construction. The projects right now that I showed you have 52% of those square feet pre-leased. So that would be an indicator that not only is there occupancy following the square footage, but the occupancy is ahead of traditional underwriting characteristics. Which... If you go again by the traditional standard that when you have pre-leasing, that is a traditional characteristic, the buildings do fill up, I would say that we are ahead of what is considered market grade. Yep.
I mean, I would say to your point, Mort, that it's not, all gain to the jurisdictions, because what you are seeing is some resorting of current office relocating in response to the preferences of workers.
Correct.
Of the talent to be near Metro. So, and we could do a little drive around the region and see the places that people are moving from. But for our purposes today, talking about what the impact is for Metro, I think you have a reason to feel pretty confident. But the conversation about the gains to the jurisdictions has to be tempered a little bit by the reality that in some cases it's not a new job. It's a job that's relocating from a less metro-accessible place to a more metro-accessible place.
Right. And I think it's important that we're viewing this through the very parochial lens of Metro. Right. This is about the title of the presentation is Impact of Short-Term Development Forecast on Metro Rail. So we may have a larger regional conversation that may be held elsewhere, but in this case we're looking at Metro Rail ridership and revenue.
But, Madam Chair?
Yes.
These are very good questions and appropriate conversation to have. I can just cite, you know, the projections that we currently are reviewing right now. As my city is going to make a city council is going to make a decision next Wednesday, the 20th, on the Potomac Yard Metro Station, which alternative to select. And we know for a fact that just by having that a new station stop in Potomac Yard is going to, first of all, it's going to allow us to with a metro station stop in Potomac Yard, we'll be able to have total density or build out of over 7 million square feet. Without a metro station, it's going to be less than half that. And so with the metro station, not only do we get 26,000 jobs, we get close to 7,000 housing units. And for the city of Alexandria over a 30-plus year period, we'll realize about $1.5 billion plus in tax revenues, but the region itself, the total value to the region by just having that station stop in Potomac Yard is going to be like $2 to $3 billion. So that's a painted picture for, you know, for all of us in terms of how important and how valuable having metro stations and development around metro stations to provide that density. But you're absolutely right. There is a shifting and a relocation of jobs and people from one place to another.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Goldman, and then I would like to let Mr. Kanaan conclude. I think he's near the end.
I am.
If he's near the end, I'll save the question.
Okay.
The impact, again, I think it's important for us as Metro to take into account is that all this development does add riders to a system that in many places where the development is taking place is already at max. So to look at Union Station and NoMa and take a look and understand that those were already places where we are cheek to jowl and try to contend with the fact that that is only going to get more pronounced as this development comes online begs the question of what are we doing to prepare for that ridership and can we mobilize the resources necessary to accommodate what should be an economic boon for the region. We also know that what this does is it increases the overall amount of bodies on the trains, and you can see here the impact that this development is likely to have upon the PPC numbers. And you're seeing here the in a scale from bluish to red, the change in persons per car at the 9 a.m. hour after this development pipeline. The trains themselves, the consists, will in fact be busier and busier in places where we're already experiencing significant busyness. And then also, finally, to close this out, the stations have a fixed amount right now of vertical circulation capacity. We have so many escalators, so many elevators, so many staircases, so many mezzanines, et cetera, et cetera. And on the left-hand side, you can see where it is that our analysis has already showed us that we are in the PM peak, very crowded today. And the right-hand side, those very crowded places don't go away with the additional pipeline. They just become more crowded. And to go back to this guideline that we've been planning towards, that we'd like to be able to clear out a station within half a headway, we need to be able to plan for the additional capacity improvements in these stations to handle the load. So I'll end there. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. One follow-up from this, could go back to that last slide,
yes.
Is whether or not those stations have the ability to have an additional entrance.
That's correct.
And that might be something that would be good for us to know. If they have that ability to have another entrance that they don't yet have, and whether or not that would change the color of those dots. Is that possible to know?
Well, we flagged stations in the strategic plan that we believe required additional vertical circulation. We can simply overlay that map on top of this. They're largely coincident. So there are plans underway that many of you have already seen about additional both intra-station as well as station vertical capacity improvements that we've proposed. Many of those are only going to become needs that are more pronounced with the development pipeline.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Goldman.
Yes, I wanted to go back to one of the earlier slides, the first or second one, that showed the actual uneven growth pattern.
Sure.
For Orlando.
Sure.
Back to the beginning. There it is. Of course, this is obviously an issue that we're wrestling with these days because of the difference between what is the current flat lining of transit metro rail, especially what are the long-term trends. So my first question is, the dotted line, which is you've marked as linear actual, how was that derived?
Oh, it's simply in Microsoft Excel, if we would take beginning point, end point, and ask it to do a simple univariate regression, what is the long-term year-over-year average rate of growth been? Now, it actually, you know, if you take apart 1994-2004, it looked like it was more about a 3% year-over-year. 2004-2014, 1.4% year-over-year. You know, long-term trend has hovered between, you know, 1.8-1.9%. But it's not the most sophisticated.
That's what I was trying to get at. It is a regression or it is not a regression?
It is the most simplest available trend line that's available in Microsoft Excel, which will do just a univariate point A to point B.
Okay. You have an interesting question.
Okay.
The question I'm trying to ask is whether this is just a line produced by sort of going point A to point B to show a trend line, or whether it's been produced by some regression analysis with inputs from the various years that are shown on the slide.
This is just a point A to point B trend line.
Okay. Next question. I think your projection was that from the development, that at some point when the development was completed, you expected about a 5% increase in ridership. 10% increase. All right. And so, but the most recent data that we'll hear about this afternoon is that for FY15 to date, the increase ridership has only been a little less than 1% mm-hmm. over the same period of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're basically flatlined. So what I'm trying to get from you as the expert is, when the line shifts from flatline to 5 to 10%, do you see that happening in 2016, or is that 2025, or somewhere in between? When do we get back on that green line? That's the COG forecast.
So the green line is the COG forecast. What I'm trying to do is to show you there are two ways of looking at ridership. One is this long-term trendalizing, which has a lot of different factors, including oil prices and, you know, global politics. What I'm pointing to is bricks and mortar. I am not going to opine on whether or not we return to the COG forecast. That's a discussion that is not the topic of this presentation, but rather I know what happens when development happens around metro rail stations and we add ridership. So I can point to the projects coming out of the ground, the ones that are supposed to be occupied by 2020, 2021, and say those will add riders at these specific locations for these reasons. And I can say that with 70 to 90% accuracy. The reason I wanted to show you this is that over the long term, we have fluctuated. We've fluctuated in times where the economics were strong, but our ridership was flat or stagnant. We have shown significant strength in times where the national economy was perhaps sour. We have grown after capacity expansion and shrunk after capacity declines and vice versa. And we needed this tool to be able to get much more fine grain at the station level so we know, absent from global from geopolitics and energy price discussions, what's going to happen as a result of the development.
So the bottom line is, as a board, we're left to figure it out for ourselves.
No. As the board, we've given you a map that shows expect to see an additional 84,000 trips per day at the station areas that we have shown you on that map by 2020-2021.
2020-2021.
That's correct.
And I think that the other point is, as these projects deliver, we'll start to see the impacts before then. But that's the analysis for when all of the projects currently in the pipeline or under construction are occupied.
To clarify, that's the analysis for when the projects that are currently under construction are expected to be occupied. Of the 100 million square feet in the pipeline, that 84,000 number is coming from only about 30% of the projects, which are the ones that are under construction today.
Okay.
There's an additional 70 million square feet of construction that's not included in this forecast because the completion dates are beyond that 5 to 7 year time frame.
Well, that's helpful, and it should give us more certainty about what we should expect to see in terms of ridership. Mr. Dormson?
Do you have any thoughts on how this analysis might
inform towards policy with the organization policy with regard to replacement parking? So there are, I know that Mr. Wall is taking a look at replacement parking, and one of the, without having done the analysis on, there are other properties that have gone through and taken this stab, this initial analysis, and done a much more robust application of that to replacement parking, BART being one of those properties that has done that. I don't want to presume that we have done that level of analysis because the truth of the matter is that replacement parking needs vary significantly based upon the location of the system in the network. There are certain stations that because of their physical location at a terminal or because of the proximity to other interstices do depend on parking in order to drive ridership. And in order to replace the ridership that would have gotten there by parking, you need to achieve densities which exceed either planned or feasible zoning. There are other stations where, because of their location in the network, it's the density and the size of the walk shed that are much more important drivers of potential ridership. Ours is a hybrid system that is part subway, part commuter rail, has both of those characteristics throughout the entire system, and I don't have a one, one answer to your question that says, yes, we have a policy.
We're asking when we see the deals that we get some of that analysis for a specific site, you know, in a specific location in the system, what ridership is driven by the parking and what ridership is driven by the development that might replace some or all of it at the site. So I think that's exactly the right question that we should be evaluating when we look at a given site, and that a blind policy that says we just replace the parking is almost certainly not appropriate for us. We should look at what whether it needs to be replaced given where it now is in the system versus where it might have been originally in the system as a terminal site, and what are the land uses around it, and what can we expect as revenue for the system and ridership and access to Metro that would come from development versus simply parking access.
Correct.
Okay, that's great. I totally agree with what you said. Is there a process right now where the planning team and the real estate team can come forward to the board prior to a solicitation and ask for a relaxation of the one-to-one replacement to just even on an experimental or demonstration basis to see what the market response would be?
I'll let Mr. Wall up to answer that, but I think the short answer is yes.
We can do that, and we are doing that for Capitol Heights in terms of our analysis of replacing less than one for one. We'll look exactly at those types of impacts and understanding what the revenue impact is from the lost riders who are not parking compared to the new riders we're getting from all of the walking ridership found in the station. We're also using this development impact tool is what we're using to create that analysis. So we're actually using that tool as our model for our joint development impacts.
Okay, but at the time that the joint development was advertised, did we state that the one-to-one replacement parking policy could be relaxed?
We have not done that yet, but we could do that in the future, yes.
I would ask that in your market soundings, particularly in Prince George's County, which I believe is being held back in terms of development because of the one-to-one replacement parking policies, that we figure out a way to get market feedback on that issue and to allow management to come forward with recommendations for more flexible solicitations and allow the local jurisdictions to have some input as to whether or not that's something that they would like to pursue, even if we just were to pilot that or to work to demonstrate that. I frankly feel that if that were pursued with Capitol Heights at the beginning, you may have had 2 to 3 respondents as opposed to one.
Okay. Mr.
Gunn,
yes. I think Ms. Hines and then Mr. Corcoran, and then this is exactly what I wanted, which was a lively discussion, but I think in the interest of time, we'll probably have those be the last two questions.
I would ask, Sean, whether you can put this together into a a short paper with some of the pictures. As I'm thinking about the work we're doing at NVTA and in some other places, the research that you've done to help people understand the importance of the walkshed and all of that is actually could be very useful to us as we talk to legislators and other people. Right now, the short description in the bias doesn't do justice to what you found in a way that I could give it to a legislator and have them understand the main point. So if there's any way, and I really would encourage similar work on bus and some of the other stuff, it really will help regional conversations if we can take what we've got here and sort of tease it out for a broader audiences and a little less, what? It is on, sorry, I just didn't put it close.
There's a detailed attachment, and also there are maps as well as text write-ups on planetmetro.com. Which are very user-friendly.
Okay, so
but if it's
I
not
apologize
there, we can get you
if I missed it, but I really, I guess I wanted to say it because I think we should all be thinking about who else do we need to give it to. Thanks.
Mr. Corkin.
Yes, to follow up on my colleague's comments, is there information, I don't think that is a Metro decision to change the parking, correct? That is a jurisdiction decision. But we can provide that information to change the density levels. Is that
requirements or things that?
But when we sell off the land, I'm saying then it becomes a jurisdiction piece. In Fairfax County, they changed the densities in the county. Not that wasn't a Metro decision.
Metro's not providing.
Correct. Right. So I don't.
That's why the difference is.
After we have sold the land?
During the solicitation as part of the joint development process.
Okay. So I stand corrected then. But is there something that we can send to all the jurisdictions that can provide this kind of information, what these impacts will have?
Just so I clarify, do you want to understand the...
So as you're looking at this redevelopment, and whether it's in Reston or Laurel or Greenbelt, to ask them to consider making changes in their requirements for parking for those pieces of land that we may be selling off?
Yeah, there are two
pieces would, and ultimately increase the value of what the solicitations.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there are two elements to what Mr. Corcoran is suggesting. So one is the requirements for our facilities and our parking, mm-hmm. and sometimes the changing those requirements frees up real estate to be developed, but the jurisdictions do have their own parking requirements in every case.
Correct.
And that those parking requirements may or may not be consistent with a policy that we might choose to say no replacement parking for Metro. So it's also true that the more land that gets devoted for parking, arguably the impact on ridership could be significant, right? So, if, for example, every unit was required to have two parking spaces, which I think is not required anywhere in our region, it would also be much less likely that those folks would be Metro riders compared to 0.25 parking spaces per unit, right?
Correct.
So absolutely their parking policies have an impact on ridership and on this conversation, for sure.
And do we have something that is provided to all jurisdictions that reflect these needs?
We have circulated a copy of the model itself to the JCC so that they can put their own inputs about potential development programs at any of the stations and understand what the ridership implications of development programs might be. They can then perhaps share those with their staff on the land use side and the planning side to impute what the parking requirements for projects might optimally be based upon the ridership impact. So the tools have been circulated to the JCC for use as they see fit.
Maybe another thing that could be done, the planning directors are convened in the region by the COG. And maybe Sham could do a presentation like this with more news you can use elements for the planning directors to kind of drive home the point that this is a tool that's useful to them as well and has impacts on their revenues and on the transit ridership. But I have to give Stan and Sham a lot of credit. There's this thing, Planet Metro, this great blog for all the, and a lot of our planning geeks in the region, myself included, follow it pretty closely because a lot of this kind of analysis with catchy graphics, short, pithy kind of vignettes of this stuff, Sean posts on it very regularly, and it's very fascinating, taken up by a lot of blogs and sometimes even even the venerable Washington Post. So, yeah. Okay, thank you for a super lively discussion.
I just have one question. Are you going to be coming back and giving us some additional information on this or no?
Why don't I work with Sean and Stan? There's more than this. There are other things that they could be talking about. I want our committee to get to hear about this stuff, like, early on so it can inform our thinking. So we'll be doing something like this probably every other session.
Yeah. No, I'm just curious, I mean, with the chart that showed the metro ridership from 75 to 2040, it would be nice to know, doing from 75 to 2017 even, what was the total development that took place so that you have something to compare it against?
Okay, absolutely. We can definitely do that, and we'll send out maybe some suggested future topics and let the committee members and the interested others maybe have some input into what you'd like to hear about next. Thank you very much for this.
Yeah, I just wanted to go on the record to remind the committee and the board, and certainly for our new members, that the issue of one-to-one replacement on parking is not a new issue. It's been raised, I can say, every time since I've been on the board for the last 4 years, with the expectation that we were going to take a comprehensive look at that, because I think it's well known that we think it's an impediment to development, and I know it is a matter Stan has been working on. So while we would be able to make some progress as we go through each development proposal, as been suggested by my colleague, I do think it's important that we systemically look at this issue and rewrite the policy.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we're adjourned.